Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It's Wednesday, November 18th, 2015. I'm here in beautiful Clearwater, Florida, where we're having kind of an autumnish day. It's only 80 degrees here in beautiful Florida. But a cold front is coming, and I'm so excited because it's time for us to have some cold. Today my guest is Pamela Seefeld. She is my guest every other Wednesday, because she has so much to share with us. She's a registered pharmacist who prefers to dispense medicinal plants and, other natural substances instead of prescription drugs. But in addition to knowing an infinite amount about the dangers of drugs and the benefits of natural remedies, she also wears another hat of being a grant reviewer for the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C. So today she's going to tell us what we need to know about scientific studies and tests so we can understand what's going on behind the scenes. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back because I think the last two every other Wednesdays, we played replays for various reasons. So now here you are live.
Yeah, I was teaching a class, and yes, I am here.
Good. Okay, so first tell us what you do as a grant reviewer. Specifically, what's your job?
Okay, well, in the past and in the future now, when I grant review, what they do is the NIH has this money that's available from the federal government. And this money is available in a grant. It's basically the money they give you. And when you write up a grant to be submitted to NIH, and there'll be a panel of maybe 12 people or something, depending on what subject matter we're doing. Like the one I usually do is herb-drug interactions or herbal medications. And that's normally done through NCAM, which is the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Okay? Mm-hmm. So what happens is, say I'm a researcher and I'm at a university and I want to get grant money, and this grant money is going to be used for a study. I submit the forms and I basically design a study. And so these people, the grant reviewers, sit around and they decide who gets the money. That's basically what it is, based on reading what your objectives are and the study design. We make summaries of these, and we actually get to see them ahead of time. We write a summary of what we think, and then we all compare if this is the person should be getting the funding. So that's basically how these are vetted.
Mm-hmm. So then, can you give me an example of like how you make the decision?
All right, good. So I'll give you an example of one that we wouldn't decide to use.
Yeah,
so one in particular that I'm not saying any names or anything, but
right.
They wanted to study a particular herbal remedy, okay? And instead of designing it where they're just looking at a standardized product of that remedy, the study design had, they were going to put in a beaker, they were going to put all these herbs in there, and then they were going to draw an extract out of it, and then they were going to go ahead and give it to people. Well, that didn't make any sense because the design in the beginning, the objective said they were studying herb X. But why are they putting all this stuff in the beaker, and then they're going to boil it down, and they're going to make this concoction? You see what I'm saying? So
these
study designs are designed to fail.
Right.
And okay. Also, product is very important. A lot of the studies that you see that are negative about vitamins are done on very poor quality products. Because let's say the grant is $50,000, whatever it is. The researcher writes in their salary, which is usually significant, to conduct the study. And so by the time they get to the product itself, they probably look for the cheapest stuff because they really don't want to have an expensive product, because the more money they have left over, the more they have for themselves, if that makes sense.
Right.
So a good example is vitamin E. Synthetic vitamin E, we know, really does not act in the body the same way as real vitamin E. Real vitamin E, taking from like wheat germ, different various plants, when they extract that, it has more bioavailability to the body, and the body recognizes it as such. So when people are using synthetic products and they're using poor quality products, and maybe these generic products, or who knows, maybe something from overseas that, you know, they're getting a cheap deal on, and maybe they're not inspected facilities, this can definitely affect outcome.
You know, I think about that a lot because I read a lot of studies. I mean, I don't read the whole entire study, but I'm reading a lot of abstracts. And sometimes I read the study because I'm reading them to find out if something's toxic or if it's saying that it's safe. And the thing that is always kind of unknown to me is it's kind of like reading a product label. There's so many unanswered questions. Like it might say, we tested vitamin C and it did this or didn't do that. But you have no idea what kind of vitamin C, if it was organic or not organic. You know, it's all these questions, and we don't get enough information about what's being tested.
Well, by far. And I think, too, and investigator bias is a big part of it, because if you're expecting to have a negative outcome, that's what you're going to find. And we know that right. In statistics, that's how you design the study, is what you're going to see. So I've actually seen study design where I know that the person really didn't want it to show an accurate result. And other studies where maybe people are biased and they just really were so gung-ho about it that they thought that this was going to work. And the time when you normally see that is when companies do studies on their own product.
Right. You want, so if somebody, if our listeners or me, or you are reading a study, so then what we want to do is the first thing would be that there would need to be an objective viewpoint. So you'd want to look and see who's doing the study.
Yes. You'd want to see who's doing the study. And actually, a lot of the negative studies, this is pretty interesting, that a lot of the negative studies that are written, St. John's Wort is not used as much as it used to be, okay? But still, it does. There is a percentage of the population that does find relief from depression from it. And it also has, there's two open trials with OCD to use that as well. So it can be effective for those conditions. And in the beginning, those original studies that showed that St. John's Wort had all these drug interactions and all these problems and didn't work were conducted by the companies that actually make the antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And it was like down in the small print.
Yeah, you want to make sure that the person doing the study doesn't have a vested interest in the outcome, that there needs to be just neutral parties. I guess
correct.
ideally when you do, so you're kind of like doing a scientific experiment, and ideally you would want to have somebody doing that experiment who is okay with it coming out either way.
That's exactly right. And we're going to have investigator bias on both sides. And then it's to be expected, but it's also important when you're interpreting negative data about supplements and their effectiveness, because usually these headlines that catch people's attention that multivitamins don't do anything for you or vitamin C is dangerous, these types of things you need to really look and see who's designing the study. A lot of times, the people that are designing the studies don't expect to have a positive outcome, and their bias is very obvious.
So when you're looking at these studies, so when people are submitting to get the grant money, then they have written out what the study is that they're going to do, and you can take a look at it and see how it's slanted even before you grant the money.
Correct. And that's why hopefully the people that are actually doing the reviewing, and most of the time, you know, these people, you know, have education and background in it anyways. So they're going to pick people that are going to be, you know, a little bit more objective. And you would hope that that's the way it always works. But in a lot of drug trials, that's not how it works. And we know that, you know, that actually the new studies have just come out that the medical literature is just riddled with all of these, you know, peer-reviewed journals that they used to think that just, you know, make them so important. Peer-reviewed, for your listeners, is that, say I publish a study, before I publish it, it goes to people that are in my same vocation, okay? So maybe they're doctors or whatever, and maybe they're in a particular field of pharmacognosy, and they review it to see that for accuracy. That's called peer-reviewed. But a lot of these peer-reviewed trial studies that they're seeing now, the results were not peer-reviewed correctly, and, you know, it's like, you know, I'm reviewing for my friend, that kind of thing. And it's not, there's a lot of inaccuracies in the medical literature. And they recently came out with that and said that a lot of it's not true, especially in psychology.
Wow. Wow.
That they can't reproduce most of the studies in psychology. It's like over 80%.
Wow, because that's supposed to be, the peer-reviewed journals are supposed to be, I mean, the places that you trust.
Well, and that's true. But what's happened is that the people that are reviewing, your peers, they're your friends too.
Yeah.
And that's what they're thinking, that there's some bias involved in there. I think it's important to just look at the study design and see if there's some sort of cohesiveness and some thought process that everything's, the product was chosen correctly, the study was done correctly. But you have to look, there will be attitudes in that. And a good example of that is homeopathic medicine, which is what I do, okay?
Okay, wait, before you go on, we need to go to break.
Yes.
And we'll talk about this when we come back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Pamela Seafeld. She's a registered pharmacist who prefers to dispense medicinal plants and other natural substances. But today, she's wearing her other hat as a reviewer for the National Institutes of Health. And we're talking about tests and studies and all about them. We'll be right back. Listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Pamela Seafeld. She's a registered pharmacist who prefers to dispense medicinal plants, but she also does grant reviewing for the National Institutes of Health, which is what we're talking about today. Pamela has a website, botanicalresource.com, and she can ship things to you from her natural pharmacy, and she also is happy to talk to you at no charge over the phone to help you find a natural remedy that will help whatever's going on with you. And also, if you're interested in getting off drugs and use a natural remedy instead, she can help you with that too. So Pamela, why don't you give your phone number?
Yes, absolutely. I would be very honored to help you or your family members and also your animals with any homeopathic remedies that you might have, or if you're wanting to transition off of some of your medications, I can definitely help you with that. You can call me here at my pharmacy. It's 727-442-4955. That's 727-442-4955.
Okay, good. So continue now with what you started to talk about before the break.
Yes. Okay, great. So I did some studies in the Library of Medicine, and I wanted to look at some of the pros and cons of some of the newest studies that just came out with homeopathics and with vitamin therapies, because just to kind of give some examples of some
Good.
Of the things we've been discussing.
Right.
Good. So complementary and alternative drug therapies versus science-oriented medicine. So there's one study that just came out in June of this year, and it was from the German Medical Society. And this German Medical Society was against homeopathy. They did not, and this is out of Germany. They were not happy about it. They thought it was, and this is one side of it, that they didn't like complementary and alternative medicine.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But then, in September of this year, oncologists in Germany are for homeopathy. And this is in the current oncology representation. So this is in another journal, and it's saying homeopathy is so great for cancer care, and that it says here, given the low cost, minimal risks, potential magnitude of homeopathy's effects, it should be considered in many situations as an integrative tool for cancer care. So this is the thing. It depends who everyone's got an opinion, right?
Right.
So if your society is against something, your position paper and your study is going to be against it. And the people that are for it, and this is pretty interesting because these actually are oncologists, they're allopathic doctors. The title is there a role for homeopathy in cancer care? Questions and challenges. And this just shows an example that there's just in the same year, same country, one person thinking it's good, one person thinks it's not any good. And really, let me tell you about homeopathy. People do not get hurt with homeopathy, okay? That's very important. When you take a regular medicine, there's a lot of side effects. Homeopathic remedies are extremely safe, extremely effective, and I've worked with them probably 20 years. I really find that they are really the bridge for health for people, because a lot of times maybe they're not responding to a medicine or they don't want to take a medicine. Homeopathic remedies, especially for liver problems, kidney problems, cancer problems, the response is very effective and very safe. And most of Europe really does embrace this. In fact, in Germany, you can go to a homeopathic doctor or an allopathic doctor, and insurance pays for both. And they also pay for the homeopathic medications in the pharmacy.
Wow. How forward thinking. So,
correct.
So now here we have the government of, I guess it's government or insurance, that insurance is paying for homeopathy. Is it social medicine or in private? Okay, social medicine. The government in Germany is paying for homeopathy and sending people to homeopathic practitioners, and yet they're still in the journals, in the medical journals, they're still saying it works or it doesn't work. Now, so this is always the question. Even if you read the newspaper, they have to give you a quote-unquote balanced view and tell you both sides. But then how are we supposed to know which side is true?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of it is research bias. If you see someone that has a certain position paper and it looks to be biased in whatever their profession is, and the good part about what I do is I'm not biased one way or the other. I do both.
Yeah, like, yeah,
my whole day is not just all integrative medicine. Part of it is working in the, you know, the ER, working and dosing medications for people that are coming in from the ambulances. So I know both. And I'm not negative against drugs, because if someone comes to me, sometimes there are times where I write down and say, they gave you the wrong prescription, there's nothing in herbal medicine for this, this is what they need to give you, and I'm right.
Yeah.
So it's really important to see about bias. I think your listeners in particular, and these are just some general questions we need to ask yourself, but especially vitamins. Vitamins tend to be a target, and I want to explain why that is. Because
yes.
The vitamins, there's really no money in for regular companies, right? They don't really want you taking them because they want you to take medicines instead. Medicine's mm-hmm. where the money's at.
Mm-hmm.
And the vitamin C, I'll give you an example, like a vitamin C. When I did some research studies here and I did some Medline searches for the potential of vitamin C, a lot of the studies were very favorable about vitamin C. I didn't see anything negative except what's called an epidemiological study. And what that is, to explain it to listeners, epidemiological studies are not really a study at all. What they do is they set somebody in front of the computer, maybe a grad student or something, and they search vitamin E and cancer. And then they put it in certain different terms. And then they go back and they search hundreds of studies, and then they look at them, and then they determine that everything's really bad. That's usually what the outcome is. But if I'm taking a study from 15, 20 years ago, and maybe I have any information about the product they used, the study design, because what you're going to find now is not going to be the full paper, maybe. Or maybe you're not going to find some detailed information about it. Or, you know, the thing is, too, there could have been contaminants. We have the FDA inspecting these facilities now. In the past, they weren't, right?
Ah, okay, yeah.
So
yeah.
You can't compare these old studies on vitamins that maybe were produced in a factory someplace that maybe the equipment wasn't cleaned properly or whatever. Now, most of the vitamin companies here in the United States in particular, they follow GMPs, which is good manufacturing practices.
Yeah.
So the equipment's cleaned. There's lot numbers, expiration dates. You don't know what they were using.
Yeah.
So these old studies that they're using to collate this data and make assumptions and decisions based on that and make a position paper for that. So when you see epidemiological, but the important thing for the listeners to realize, when you see epidemiological study, it's not necessarily true.
Okay, good. We'll talk more about this when we come back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. My guest today is Pamela Seafeld. She's both a registered pharmacist. As she said, she works in the hospital, and she also has her own natural pharmacy where she has homeopathic remedies and other natural substances that can help heal your body. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Pamela Seafeld. She's both a registered pharmacist, and she has a natural pharmacy where she dispenses natural remedies and homeopathic remedies. So, Pamela, during the break, I was reading my emails, and yeah, that's what I do during the break. I got an article about asking, is there plastic in sea salt? And apparently they did. This was reported in the... Okay, so now here's an example of a study and a journal. So, and this is a journal I read a lot, Environmental Science and Technology. And all they talk about in this journal is studies that show that things are toxic. And so, or not toxic. It's all about toxicity. And so... what one of these studies found by examining the sea salt was that there are extremely tiny pieces of plastic in sea salt. And now the sea salt that they examined, and again, this gets back to now. Here, I'll tell you what it said, and then you can comment on this instead of me commenting on it. Okay, so the plastic the sea salt came from China, and they found, they measured more than 1,200 particles of plastic per pound of sea salt. Now, I know that you eat Himalayan salt like I do.
Yes.
And the difference between sea salt and Himalayan salt is that all salt is from the sea originally, except that some of these seas are extremely ancient and are now buried at the bottom of places like the Himalayan mountains. And so the salt
Correct.
That they dig up out of the ground in the Himalayas, even though it was originally an ancient sea, it has been sitting there since the beginning of time. and so there's no way that plastic is going to get in Himalayan salt, whereas salt that is comes from evaporating seawater. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you all listening have ever seen this, but I used to live in San Francisco, and so every time I would come in on an airplane right next to the airport, that's a great place to put this. But right next to the airport are these are these fields where they have just kind of made like little. Little sections where they've blocked off the water and that the seawater comes in from the San Francisco Bay and they evaporate it, and you can see all the fields in various stages of evaporation, and that's where the sea salt comes from. It comes from all the pollutants in San Francisco Bay and right next to all the pollution from being right next to the airport, and that's sea salt. That's that sea salt.
Well, what you're saying, I believe there's plasticizers in there, absolutely. They're evaporating. We know that there's high quantities of plastic, small microbes, small amounts of plastic in the seas. That's not any new news. So actually, I believe that study. I really do. And the fact about Himalayan salt, if you talk about rock salt, any type of rock salt from an ancient seabed, the reason why you see all those colors is those are animals that have deceased, and you're taking the nutrients that were in those shells and in those animals that are buried in this salt.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's so much more nutritious, because you're getting all the trace minerals, and especially the Himalayan salt, because all the pink, you have a lot of iron.
Right, right. And real salt is also from under the ground.
Yes.
Those are the two.
I like both of them, but I think the Himalayan tastes a little sweeter.
I think it does, too. I like the taste. And
yeah.
But I use both of them kind of alternating back and forth.
Me too.
Real salt has one that they have a garlic salt with organic granules of garlic, and I really like that one.
Oh, I got to try that. That sounds good.
Yeah, they have four or five flavored ones. It's really good. Anyway, so here's an example of a study where they actually counted something.
Correct, and that actually is a very good example. Even though the people that were doing it were probably expecting to find the plastic, the fact that they went and counted how many parts per million of the salt, and they went and probably did a spectrometer and measured that,
mm-hmm.
that to me seems like a valid study, and I would definitely not think there's so much investigator bias. I'm sure a person that would be doing it from maybe the salt company itself, too, if they're really evaluating it under the same circumstances that they did originally, they would find the same thing. And we would expect that.
We would expect that. And I think that a lot of times I see studies because of what I'm looking at. I'm not particularly looking at drugs or things like that.
Yes.
I'm reading studies that are like this, where they're talking about some kind of consumer product. And so I read something like, is plastic leaching out of plastic water bottles? You know, and so there's some speculation or there's some reason to believe that there's something going on, and then the study is there to confirm it.
We know the plastic. You're exactly right. And the plastic is coming out of water bottles. It's coming out of food you heat in the microwave.
Right.
And that's actually there's a product called Detox 3. That's a homeopathic that pulls out plastics out of the body, and especially if somebody has a high breast cancer risk, or has had breast cancer, or they just want to clean that out of their body, you can put this in a detox bottle every day, and that will pull off these microscopic amounts of plastic that are in your body.
Yeah. We should just explain what a detox bottle is.
Okay, yeah. A detox bottle is when you take a bottle of water every day, and normally I tell people to put the body anew, which is a detox product that pulls out nickel, cadmium, lead, mercury, pesticides, chemicals, and you just put 10 drops of each bottle in this bottle of water, and then if you need to add something else in the water that's for your particular needs. Like I use a lot of something, I've used something called Cortego Complex if you have hypertension. Detox 1 is for the liver if your liver enzymes are elevated. Detox 2 is for the kidney if your serum creatinine is starting to elevate at all, or if you have kidney stones. Detox 3 is for plasticizers. And so there's lots of different homeopathics. I probably have maybe 75 different kinds here. And if, depending on what you need, maybe thyroid support, and, you know, antidepressants, whatever. You put this in the water and you drink it over the course of the day. And that's what we mean by a detox bottle. And Detox 3 is a particular product that is meant to remove plasticizers. And I got that specifically for a lot of the breast cancer patients. Because you, a lot of times we know breast cancer, you know, these plasticizers act like estrogen in the body.
Yeah. So
and that's where a lot of this is coming from.
Yes, yes. I also want to just mention to, for since we're talking about salt, I just want to finish up and say that if you, so I don't buy packaged foods. I don't even buy most what are called natural foods or even some organic foods. That I just try to stick with buying fresh foods and putting my own salt on it. And that way I know what it is. I know the water it was washed in. You know, if they're washing foods in tap water, then you're getting chlorine absorbed into or
Absolutely.
Fluoride or whatever. You know, it's just you just don't know what's in packaged food. And unless they are really upfront about telling you exactly how they do it. But if it says sea salt on the label, this is what it is, a bunch of little bits of plastic. So we need to go to break. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Pamela Seefeld. And when we come back, we'll talk more about studies and tests. We haven't talked about how to test a test yet, so we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Pamela Seefeld. She's a registered pharmacist who prefers to dispense medicinal plants, but she also dispenses drugs when that's warranted. And anyway, she can help you choose either one. And sometimes she helps people, can advise people on taking a different drug that might work better for you. So Pamela, why don't you give your phone number again, and then let's talk about testing a test.
Okay, good. So you can call me here at my pharmacy, and I would be, like I said, very honored to help you or your family if you had a question about your medications, even your blood work if you want some interpretation on that. You might see what vitamins are working well for you or which ones are not. You can call me here at my pharmacy at 727-442-4955.
Great. So testing a test.
All right. So studying a study and testing a test, what we want to know is, you know, we're looking at different methods, okay? And mm-hmm. when we look at studying a study and testing a test, we have several things we look at. First thing we look at is method and assignment, and I'll go through those.
Okay.
Results is number two. And number three is interpretation and extrapolation, okay? So what this means is method, okay? What study population are you looking at? Or are you looking at? You know, most of the time you'll set the criteria. Like, they don't do a lot of studies in children, which for obvious reasons,
mm-hmm.
for consent and so forth. But a lot of the studies are probably done, let's say, adults 18 to 30 years old, something like that. So you're not getting in the elderly people. If you're looking for a young, healthy population, that's when you're sometimes your best results. And sometimes they do use older people if they're studying medications that are specifically going to be used in that population. So the first thing you look at is the method. And under the method, it's the study population. So what kind of group of people, what age group do you choose? And also with study population, you have to look and see, are they smokers or are they not smokers? You know, maybe the control for diet. You know, how many servings of fruits and vegetables do they have a day? You can see my point. So,
yeah.
So method is important. You have to look at the method and see did they ask people about their dietary habits and smoking and drinking and things like that to see if those things might. Especially, let's say we're doing a study on a drug for liver failure, or to prevent liver failure. How about herb? Milk thistle. I love milk thistle. Protects liver against the liver problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you're doing a study on that, right, and the majority of the people that you have in the study drink a liter of vodka every day, you might see a different result than if you take a bunch of people that are at a health food store and never drink at all. So
yes.
Those are important because those would be a confounding variables, right?
Well, do they screen for things like that?
Yes.
Okay.
A good study, if you look at the methods, say you're doing an herbal study, and you want to see the methods of what they're doing, they're doing something that's maybe it's an herb for the liver, an herb for the lungs. You want to look at the people they're doing. Like, if I was designing a study for the lungs and I wanted to see an outcome, you really want to have people that have problems, right? Because you want to see if it's improving.
Right.
But if you're taking people that are generally healthy and you don't see any change in their baseline status, you wouldn't have expected it to happen anyways. And that's where I see a lot of these kind of studies. If they really don't want to show anything to happen, they'll take a product that we really think will work pretty well for something, and they'll use healthy people. Well, if they're not sick, how do you expect to see anything different?
I mean,
this is stupid.
It's so obvious. It's so obvious.
Right. So looking at methods is important. Like, what kind of people did they screen out? And also, you know, you need to look at the size of the population, because a lot of these, when you see a study, it'll say N, meaning number. N equals. Well, if the study, the N number is like four people, N equals four, well, how are you going to see anything? We have so few people. I see a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I see that too, especially, like, I forgot what it was. Oh, it was something about GMOs. Where somebody had commissioned a study, and they had a big splash about it, and then it turned out that they had tested eight people.
Exactly. And, perfect example. N equals eight. I mean, really, you're not going to expect to see that much for N equals eight. That's not going to work.
No. So how many is a good amount?
Well, it just depends on what you're studying. I mean, I don't think we can really make a generalization, but I would say at least 50 people.
Yeah.
You know, a sizable amount. And if you're looking for a drug that has a lot of dangerous side effects, you'd really want hundreds and thousands maybe. So that's important to see. So method's important. Assignment is basically your study sample, your control group, and your study group, right? So somebody gets placebo, somebody doesn't, right?
Yeah.
Say you have N equals 50, 25 get placebo, 25 get the medicine. So that could be what we're looking at as well. Assessment, I mean, this is kind of mundane stuff, but it's important you look at these things. Do you look at the study groups? Do they use a control? And your outcome is, what kind of results are you getting with these control and the study group? So you look at your outcomes, and your outcome is hopefully you see a positive result. And you see no result with the people that got placebo. But remember, with placebo, it's probably 30% of the people sometimes have response, maybe even higher.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take that into consideration. And then under results, you compare. You compare both of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after the comparison, you draw conclusions. And these conclusions, the conclusions you make, are you trying to extrapolate it to other people besides just the ones that were in the study group? So that's when you make generalizations about the other people you're going to treat.
Okay. So they test it. They do their test, whatever it is, and then they say,
right.
Okay.
We're
going to take
group.
These results and say that, you know, what we learned from these 50
what
people.
What we learn, and when we read these things, we're extrapolating it to the general population. And so, say we have N equals 50, 25 and 25. They're split between 25 get the medicine, 25 don't. They're doing great. Everything's fine, and we see a positive outcome from whatever herb it is. Say milk thistle for liver problems. The liver enzymes of these people, their baseline liver enzymes have been elevated, and now they're decreasing, right? So we see that things look better, and then we say to the general population, let's say they know in an estimation, let's say 10% of the people in the country have baseline ALT and AST, which are the liver enzymes elevated, whatever it is. I'm not sure the percentage. But those, we could say those people, if the response rate was, let's say 80%, it's pretty high, that these other people could expect similar responses.
Right.
And that's where you would get this, by looking at the methods, looking at the results and interpretation, and seeing how many. The N number is really probably where you're going to see a lot of it. And I'll tell you, I looked here and did some Medline searches, and like with vitamin C and in vitamin D, there's a lot of really good data, good studies that show how effective it is for preventing vitamin C in particular, preventing type 2 diabetes. Another one here is using as an adjunct cancer treatment. Vitamin D, actually, too, they found that low levels of vitamin D, some of the newer studies, that the low levels of vitamin D cause extreme fatigue. And I thought one of the more interesting ones I found, because this is all just published in the last few months, vitamin E supplementation decreased liver fat content. So people have fatty liver as a result of having diabetes, elevated blood sugar, maybe they're heavy drinkers. You know, fatty liver is really a very, very common problem because the liver will start infiltrating with fat if the sugars are elevated for any length of time. And what they're finding is that vitamin E seems to decrease liver fat, and it prevents fibrosis.
Wow. There's so many positive things.
I mean, these studies actually look pretty good. You know, you look at method and everything, and it looked really good. So it's important to see N number methods. How was the study conducted?
You know, I've learned so much from you today about this. I can understand much better now what I'm reading and what to look for. I want to just ask you one last question because we only have a couple of minutes left.
Yeah.
And you may not even have an answer to this question, but I want to ask you anyway. And that is, it seems to me that there's a lot of studies done, and then what happens is not much if they find out that there's something wrong. And so you have something like, for example, drugs that instead of looking at it and saying, oh, here's a list of 25 side effects, let's not put this drug on the market. They put the drug on the market, and then they play beautiful commercials and say over the beautiful music, and by the way, you might have liver failure and die.
And they do that a lot.
And why isn't anything happening about just like banning these things? Why do these harmful products, whether they're drugs or anything else, why do they get to go on the market?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that necessarily they're all harmful. They obviously have shown some response rate. Was there bias in the investigators? It's possible. But there's, you know, a lot of these medicines are being marketed to protect people against cardiovascular disease and some of the things. You know, in the past, a lot of people died from heart attacks. And a lot of people died from strokes and these cardiovascular events and thrombotic events, and now a lot of people live. So some of these medicines have good effects, but a good example is all these blood thinners that they have people on for AFib and for all these heart conditions. There's going to be a percentage of the people that are going to bleed out, and that's a very dangerous thing, and that's why it's important that the cardiologist and the pharmacist and that your family practitioner, if you're being put on any medicine that has a lot of side effects and has a narrow therapeutic range, and that we define that as being that the toxic dose and the dose of therapeutic efficacy is small, so you've got to be very careful. You need to make sure that you're monitoring your blood work, make sure you're looking for side effects, and if there's something that looks suspicious, you need to call your doctor right away, because or the pharmacist, or call me. I can give you some ideas. Also, too, if people are on blood thinners and they're on some of these dangerous medicines, you can use vascular stabilizers that'll circumvent some of the blood vessel capillary fragility and breaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to the end.
That would be an option.
So why don't you give your phone number again if people want to call you? Pamela's happy to talk to you for free.
Yes, please call me. I'd be glad to help you. And the number here at Botanical Resource is 727-442-4955.
Good. And we've got to go. Thank you so much, Pamela.
Thank you.
To Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindhad. Be well.